Create with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine. Welcome to the 75th episode of Robots. Today's show features David Saint-Ange, an engineer working at the interface of visionary arts and creative science. After his talk at the Human-Robot Interaction Conference in Switzerland this spring, Amanda was able to catch him for an interview. But first, as always, let's listen to the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. Researchers at the Institute of Dynamic Systems and Control at the ETH Zurich have taught two quadrocopters to juggle a ball by passing it between them. In a video released this week, two flying robots can be seen intercepting a ball thrown by a human operator and then passing it between each other by repeatedly hitting it with badminton rackets mounted on their frames. The feat in control engineering was achieved by using model-based control and by estimating vehicle and ball positions using a high-frequency motion capture system. It follows the group's earlier demonstrations of quadrotors playing a piano, balancing an inverted pendulum, and dancing to music. German industrial control and automation company Festo, who you may remember from our interview with Markus Fischer, our previous report on their autonomous kite, has now demonstrated a lifelike flying model of a seagull. The robot, called SmartBird, uses a single electric motor and four servos to accurately emulate a seagull's wing, head, and tail movements. The robot can autonomously take off and land as well as fly, and given enough wind, even hover without using energy from its motor. In-flight control is provided by the active twist of its wing and the movement of the tail. For more videos of the ETH Zurich's ball juggling quadrocopters and Festo SmartBird, as well as more news, have a look at www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks, Christine. David Saint-Ange is an engineer in arts and works for visionary artists to give them the technological tools they need to express their talent and vision. In Canada, he trained as a mechanical engineer specialized in building structure and roboticist, and also followed graduate studies in project management to acquire the necessary tools to work in such a multidisciplinary context. More recently, he chose to exclusively specialize in artistic projects involving robotics. The most prominent of his projects includes the Flying Cube project dubbed Sails, which is an art, science, technology, research-stimulating platform initiated by Nicholas Reeves, a professor and researcher-creator at the Design School of UQAM, with whom David collaborates closely.
Hi, David, and welcome to Robots.
Hi, Amanda.
Would you please start off by explaining your extraordinary curriculum vitae and why and at what point you decided to link design with your work in engineering?
Well, I have to go back to before I entered university, actually. I decided to go in engineering education because I saw a making of one of our most famous entertainment company back there in Montreal, Cirque du Soleil. And actually, in this show, Varakai, they were using the service of many different engineers from a company to design a specific device and props for their show. And I was like, oh, that's exactly what I want to do. I want to be one of those engineers creating new device, new systems for such a theater and artistic performance like that. So then I went in university studying mechanical engineering, and I've worked in theater, and now I'm in more in contemporary art.
What fascinates you about this combination
of engineering and art? Well, a lot of things. It's hard just to state on one big point that fascinates me more than another. I would say that actually it's just a perspective that many of the artists, most if not all of the artists that I've worked with, are having of what we're developing. So I've been working in different companies, more or less in classic engineering and in labos also that are developing in classic research path. And it's always interesting to see what the artists think of those technologies and how they want to use it. If you take an artist and you're doing a lab tour with this artist, the question that you're gonna have from the artist about your stuff, your device, your work, are really. Completely different, of course, from the one that you will have from an engineer, but are really interesting in terms of the reflection it will start in the engineer head, actually. So based on that, I'm trying to bring more artists to visit the labs where I'm working in, just to provoke those kind of discussion with the researcher in engineering labs. But also there's many advantage of working with artists just because they're taking the technology that normally will be somehow closed into the labs, and they're right away taking them to an artistic performance, a public performance, which in some way democratize our technology by putting them right away in contact with the public so that they can quickly understand what is going on in the lab more or less in an artistic installation.
Since several years now, you've been primarily working on a project called SAILS, the acronym of which is Self-Assembling Intelligent Lighter-than-Air Structure, in collaboration with Professor Nicholas Reeves. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Of course. Do I have some hours? Or okay, so well, the project the robotized version, should I say, of the project start 6 years ago. The idea was to create a symbol of an architecture free of the law of gravity, free of the nature law, a symbol of an age-old myth, actually the myth of flying cities as developed by Krutikov, a Russian futurist, or that a myth that is present also in many contemporary or older architecture. So the idea of Nicholas Reeves was to create a symbol of such architecture, create a unit representing somehow the buildings, like a brick or like a Lego, maybe, a geometrical shape that actually is not developed to be aerodynamic, but completely at the opposite, actually, that is developed on purpose to be absolutely non-aerodynamic. And just by doing that, actually, having the vision of a shape, a geometry that looks really massive, really really heavy, but that actually floats. That was the idea. And then you're having an architectural statement by itself just by the view, the visual representation of this heavy mass that is floating, hovering. And then Nicholas Reeves' will was to create, in some point, a kind of 3D printer. So instead of developing a new architecture or a new design on a screen, on a computer screen, you can right away print it with this 3D printer floating, and the geometry will assemble together and create your architecture, your design in the air, and then the architect or the designer can go through it and really feel its own architecture within the real material floating over him or around him. So this is the concept, as I said earlier, the first prototype we've made, or the first shape we developed, and the unique one until now was a cube. So we're still using this cube because it's in somehow easy geometry to develop and then to assemble one to another. So all the prototype that have been developed until now on the SAILS project are cubes, but now we're thinking on going further with other geometry that will have still the ability to assemble.
What are the main components of this system?
Well, basically you're having the blimp that we're filling with helium. The blimp is made by a company in Canada specialized in meteorological observation systems. So they made this custom blimp for our needs, cubic shaped, that we fill with helium. And then this blimp is stretched to really have a perfect cubic shape with an exoskeleton. The exoskeleton in the first prototype were made of balsa, plastic, and then basswood. The first working version actually was in basswood, but it was still fragile, and nowadays we're using version of made of carbon fiber, structure made of carbon fiber. It's still homemade. By this I mean that we developed the whole structure in carbon fiber with finite element analysis, but we're still building it and made assembling it by hand. It's based on rod tubes and stripes that you can assemble easily assemble together. So then you're having the blimp, the structure, and of course the structure also holds all the mechatronic systems. So you're having 8 or 12 turbofans, propellers that are actually the actuators for the robot to move in the space. Then you're having many different sensors depending on what exactly you want to do with the robot, what interaction you want with either the visitor or the actors, or what knowledge you want the robot to have of his environment. So for this purpose, there's also many hubs on the structure at different places so that you can easily change the configuration of the sensor. And then all this information is sent to a main computer on board that is processing all this data and sending the information to the motors.
So it's fully autonomous?
It's fully autonomous, yeah. That's the objective of the project, to have a fully autonomous blimp. Mm-hmm.
But can you also telecommand them?
Yeah, of course. Actually, in some of the installation that we've did in the past, the space was too huge and too aggressive to for the robot to autonomously control itself. So we had to teleoperate it. But the first tries we made to teleoperate the robot failed, actually, because it's really, really hard to manipulate such robot. They're so big. The Trifon, the last prototype, is 2.25 meter. They're so powerful with the motors that they have on them, the last version of the motors we installed them. And they're having a so huge inertia that it's really non-intuitive to try to teleoperate those robots. So what we're doing now is that we're having an assisted system of teleoperation using a compass and accelerometer to be able for a user to, after a couple of minutes, understand how to teleoperate it and then be productive using it.
Your blimps have been hugely successful in the art world. You've installed numerous exhibitions and installations all over the world. What was the most exciting or startling project involving these blimps in one of these installations for you?
Oh, all the installations we've made were really, really awesome and really spectacular, actually. I don't know. Each time we're going toward a new installation, it's always like the last one is bringing new challenge and new possibility, new potentials. So yeah, the last one is always the more thrilling because it's the closest to us. But still, since the first one that we've made, each has so great challenge and each of them was completely different. We never did twice the exact same installation. We're always developing new prototypes or new behaviors or new sensing abilities for each installation. So it's really hard to compare them one to the other. I would say that they all were awesome.
Right. One specific project I'm thinking of here is the floating head experiment. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. So actually, that's our last artistic installation. So since some years, we're going toward studying on a nature eye point of view, human-robot interaction point of view, the reaction of the visitor toward the cube, and try to develop behaviors of the cube to interact with either actors or visitors. So going into this direction, we collaborate with Mark Sagittari Laboratory from the University of Western Sydney in Australia. And they developed the TAMS model, which is actually standing for a talking and thinking head attention model and behavioral system. So this system, based in MATLAB environment, create emerging behavior for the robot and then send that to the robot according to different sensors that are external of the robot. So mainly they developed it for a robotic arm, which was holding an LCD screen with a 3D avatar on it. In collaboration with an Australian artist, also Stellark. And then we adapt the whole system that they create with their support, of course, for the use on the cells prototype, the last one, the Trifon prototype. So the Trifon had different state that he could do, different action that he could do, more or less linked with the movement of an head. And the avatar head was also projected on the cube. And the TAMS model was interpreting all the data from the different sensors, stereo vision, from the selling motion sensor, keyboard inputs, different sensor like that that were in the theater room. And according to those sensor input, it's create emerging behavior for the robot model. So the floating head experiment occurred in Montreal at the end of last October, October 2010. And there it was just for one day. So it was really, like the title say, an experiment. And visitor would just come in and try to interact with the cube and ask the avatar some question at which the avatar will answer in a more or less philosophical way. Mm-hmm. So that was the concept.
The nice thing about this blimp, it seems to me, is that it's intrinsically so soft and friendly looking that it's kind of ideal to do these human-robot interaction studies on.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reaction that with the robots are quite different, culturally speaking, but also depending on the age of the agent interacting with the robot. So you're having a lot of kids that are afraid of the blimp because of its size. It really looks somehow dangerous, or that can attack you. Of course, we had some visitor also that were wondering, is it dangerous? I mean, if there is a leak in helium balloon or anything, would it fall on me? Is it? It really looks heavy, and as I said earlier, that's the point actually of this project. So since it looks heavy, it looks a little bit dangerous, or that it can attack you, that is powerful over you. And then at the tall opposite, you're having others that found that it looks like a pet, like some really, really funny animal, trying to get out of his cage to interact with people. One of the exhibition we've made, one of the installation we've did was in Vinzavod Art Gallery in Moscow, where the cubes actually were pets, more or less. They were geometric butterfly, as the title of the installation. And the only behavior they had, except to avoid obstacle, was to be afraid of the light surrounding them. So all the people were trying to interact with them with small pocket lights or with their cell phone, trying to afraid those huge cube. But the cubes, since they were always surrounded by lights, they were always moving around and trying to get out toward the visitor, and then the visitor were afraiding them. So a lot of people stay there looking at those robots for hours and hours, and just because they really look like small animals, and you're trying to understand how they're thinking, what they're thinking about. And I even had a discussion with a psychologist that was trying to find patterns in each of the cube, even though for us in engineer world, we could think like that. Of course, they're all having the same behavior, the same program, the same algorithm, but the interpretation, the perception the visitor has is completely different and really interesting. So that's why we're going toward this direction, of course, as one of the many direction of development we're doing right now. With the floating end experiment, the interesting point is also that now we're going really on purpose toward a real embodiment of the robot. So we're not letting anymore the visitor interpret it. Is it an animal? Is it more human? Is it just a geometrical shape, non-living form? We're really forcing it to understand it and interpret it as a human being because of the projection on it. And then we want, according to the data and to the reaction of the visitor, we want to go back to just the basic shape and see, interpret what's the difference between it and how the visitors see just a basic geometrical shape, cubic shape, floating, hovering, depending on the behavior we're giving them.
To change the subject slightly, mm-hmm. What is the challenge in or opportunity in working so closely with artists?
there's we spoke a little bit earlier about that. The opportunity actually is to there's great challenge. Let's start by that for engineered working with artists, both on the culture and the methodology of your work. So, for example, mostly in robotic, as an engineer, you will develop a new platform that will be mostly an experimental platform that won't go out of the labos, that will stay there just for your experimental result to gather data, maybe to publish a paper, and maybe, who knows, some days, some years, or just months after, to develop a new version that will then be commercialized or that will get out of in the field to be tested. And when you're working in an artistic project like that, there's no such prototype that is sticking into the lab. Each single prototype is meant to go outside the lab in a public presentation. So it means that every single prototype has to be a lot more robust that we use to develop it in I would say, traditional engineering a pattern, methodology. So you have to think each time in your design, even for a little prototype, just to test one or two behavior or one or two mechatronics thing, you have to already think of the robustness of this system and think when you're going to develop this particular board or this part of the structure, will it resist to an experiment in front of the public for 2-3 months? So that's a great challenge for engineer. And also there is, as I mentioned, another factor that is the cultural language. I've been working with many different artists in the last years, and this is a point that mainly was solved by one person, either the artist or the engineer, being sensible to the other culture already. So an engineer that is really interested already in the kind of artwork that the artist is doing, or on the other side, an artist that is really interested in development of the technology that this engineer is doing and is aware of those development and knows the language of the other. But there is also a third way of doing things. There is also to create this cultural language translation, if I can say. You can create an environment, which we're trying to create at Hexagram Siam and already lead to many successful projects, where actually you're bringing together in the same space scientists and artists different from different field of art and from different field of science or engineering to work together in the same space, so that they're forced to exchange, they're forced to collaborate together, and then they start to develop I don't know if they really developed an understanding of the other language properly, of the or if they just create a new kind of culture in research, a third culture that is to bring together those two cultures and create something else than that is getting out of mutual understanding. And so that's what we're trying to do at Hexagram, and it does succeed quite well. And then you're exchanging also knowledge from one project to the other, and you're having a lot of communication between the artists. It's more, maybe a little more focused on the way artists may work in an artistic workshop than focused on the way engineer will work in a laboratory. So it's always open space. It's always focused on communication, on exchanging and on sharing ideas. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a way to bring those two culture together. But that's a huge challenge.
If you would have to put it down to either one or the other, who do you think takes more advantage of this collaboration, the artistic community or the scientific community?
There's advantage for both sides. There's no side taking more advantage than the other. I mean, in a proper collaboration, there's no side taking advantage of the other. Of course, there's a lot of example of artists hiring engineer or scientist or just taking technology that has been developed already in a lab and then using it for their artwork. But in my speech, I'm not speaking of such work. I'm speaking of true collaboration. So the true collaboration will mean that for both the engineer or the scientist and the artist, there's a breakthrough to be done. There's an advance in its own field to the consequence of this research, of this collaboration. So, no, it's a win-win collaboration, I think, as long as you understand each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this brings me to my final question. Mm-hmm. What is your ultimate ambition in this project?
In this particular project... the ultimate ambition, there's many. Actually, to generalize maybe a little, our ambition is to make it robust enough so that we can easily, and to develop inside the creation team, the knowledge to be able to create different shapes and different scale of those robots so that we can use them quite easily for different artistic presentations. So we're always thinking and we're always going toward artistic installation and performances. And for that, we need it to be a lot more robust. We need the shapes to be different also. We need to just develop the knowledge to create those tools, but also those, they're at the same time tools for artwork and the artwork itself by their visual aspect as a visual art installation, as sculpture, if I can say. So those two aspects to continue like that, we still have to develop a lot of the technology and also on the other side, the artistic potential, because there is nothing like that neither in the artistic realm or in the engineering realm. So in both sides, we need to develop to go toward that and develop the potential also of this. We spoke of many, many applications like being a screen that you can disassemble and assemble back with projection on it or with embedded projector, as being a protagonist of a theater act in itself, being completely autonomous, being scripted like the actors are more or less, and then interacting with the other actors in the theater, in the theater act, as being part of a research platform for swarming behaviors or assembling behaviors, and then maybe lead to the 3D floating printer that I was speaking earlier about. So there are just some of the many, many applications we're seeing of this project in both fields. And it already led to many scientific publications as well as many artistic installation, some of them we discussed earlier. So yeah, I think we should just go toward the same way and try to convince more and more people to get in the project and bring new ideas and new application to this project.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, David.
My pleasure.
That's it for today's episode of Robots. For more information on our guests, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks. Create with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.